if it went to war with Iran. We have not experienced the level of military response in a conflict that we would experience if we engaged with Iran for decades. If we got body bags sent back to the United States the way that we would if this terrible situation, if the Israelis had their way, played out, there would be internal strife in the United States that would maybe destabilize it to the point of no return. And so I think because of the situation with Gaza, because of the situation with Israel having, you know, the neocon doctrine, clean break document from back in the 90s, they've checked off all of their countries, their axis of evil. Iran is the last remaining one. It came to a point when Trump came into office that Israel thought, this is our chance. This is when we're going to make it happen. It's now or never. And Trump is faced with the choice between being possibly the most disastrous president of my lifetime or someone who stood up against it. And I think Trump's own nature is to want negotiation and to say, first of all, I'm the one in charge, not Bibi Netanyahu. And so I think the issue of finding out that his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, was secretly meeting behind his back with Netanyahu in order to make this war happen contributed to a sense that, of pride's sake, Trump can't continue down this path. And so even if I don't love what he's doing with the Saudis right now, I do think that it is a bit of a slap in the face to Israel. And so I think that's positive. And from what I see in consuming U.S. media, I do think the rift is real because I see that the Trump surrogates are speaking out against Israel for the first time in a way that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you could have never imagined an American politician saying. For example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's a representative in the Trump camp, very strong figure in Make America Great Again. She said the other day that the Americans are tired of being lied to and going to war for Israel. This is something amazing to hear from a Republican politician. Matt Gaetz, who Trump originally selected as his attorney general, also recently went on a podcast and said, it's a little strange if whether you're on the right or the left, if you make legitimate criticisms of the Israeli government, they call you anti-Semitic and that you have to toe a certain line from both parties on Israel. For these truths to be said out loud to me suggests that, yes, this rift is real, and Americans cannot tolerate this anymore. For all of the money that they've put in, the Adelsons, the main Zionist donors, they can't compete with the fact that the grassroots base of Trump, the youth, are totally over with Israel. Even the evangelical Christians, the young ones, they don't support Israel in the same way that the older baby boomer generation does. Right now, polls say that over 60% of American Republicans do not want war with Iran. Uh-huh. And 10 years ago, those people would have been more susceptible to propaganda, and they're not now. I don't think you can undo that. And so I'm hopeful. It's going to take a lot of work, and there's a lot of darkness that comes when you start to talk about the Israeli situation. Even the truth about the JFK files, for example, when Trump declassified some of those, we started to see Israel mentioned a lot more when it came to that plot. So that's what you're dealing with when you start to question the Israeli special relationship. But again, I think it's inevitable. We cannot continue to be this way. I mean, whether it's our speech rights at home being taken away on behalf of this foreign government.
Yes, of course, we've seen their universities.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting to see Trump's base even complaining about, they said we wanted deportations, but not for this. We wanted, you know, to look at this crisis that we had of millions of people coming across the border and disappearing into the country. We weren't worried about university students writing op-eds about Israel while here on legitimate visas and green cards. It's exposing the level of control to a point that Americans have never really seen before. And in that way, once you rip the mask off and you see the ugly monster, people are going to want to put it down.
Right. And one could say, despite all the casualties in Gaza, taking into account the big picture, we could see that this entire thing is backfiring against Israel, but could we see a similar move, meaningful move, by the U.S. government regarding Gaza, trying to this blockade and a war there?
I think that we're unfortunately taking baby steps. At this point, we're dealing with rhetoric and just trying to stop the escalation of the situation with Iran. But of course, if Trump really wanted to make a deal tomorrow, he could say he's ending aid to Israel and force them to let aid across the border. But we're not there yet. Unfortunately, I don't think the bravery or the situation isn't prepared for that level, and that's disappointing to me because, of course, it's nice to talk about all the theories of the changing world, but when there are people suffering at the level there is in Gaza, it's pretty hard to tolerate, and there's this feeling of helplessness that I've even struggled with personally since this war began.
All of us, I think. And as an investigative journalist, how do you pick your topics to work on?
Usually it comes from conversations with people, a source or someone that might have information, and they share it with me, and then I just go down a rabbit hole. Since I became a mother, I kind of had to slow down because the rabbit hole can be never-ending, and it can kind of be all-consuming. So I'm more focused on a family these days, but usually it's, or if I have a question, if I notice something about the way that news is being presented on the mainstream, and I see something else through my international networks, you know, friends in Iran or elsewhere that are showing another side, then I kind of have to try and find the information to present. We say that the gray zone is trying to break the media blockade in the United States, that in the U.S. we just have one view presented. So sometimes they make that job pretty easy. For example, the way that they attack Iran is so extreme that it's pretty easy to tell the other side. All you have to do is show up here and show the reality of life. And sometimes something as simple as that can make a big difference in the United States because we are lied to so much. In Venezuela, too, we were told that there's no food, everybody's starving, everybody's killing each other and dying. All we had to do was go there and film the reality to make a big impact. Here they say that there are no religious minorities or that women are treated terribly. All we had to do was come here and film religious minorities and women walking in the street or me walking in the street to show that that's not the case. Sometimes it's more, it takes more of an effort to do an investigation, like I said, with documents, court documents, or sometimes focusing on an individual character. That's something I did a lot with my book, was taking the individuals who were leading the coup and going into their background deep. And then the story kind of emerges that they're all tools of the United States.
I see. That is very interesting. And of course, research is a huge part of your work as an investigative journalist. And mainstream media try to get you far and away from true material. How do you to kind of make your way through and find them?
The internet has given us great resources, and for all the faults of X and the problems with it that are clear, it has also served as a great tool for connecting people around the world. Traveling to places and meeting people, that to me is the greatest key. That's the greatest source of information, is people to people.
Anya, this is really interesting. We're going to talk about it some more, but after a quick break. Good. Well, we're approaching the end of our program. Anya, I don't know, time really flies. I really did not realize the passing of time because I wanted to keep talking to you for hours. I really enjoyed this conversation. We are at the end of our show. We have about a minute. Take your time. Talk to the camera right behind me and straight to our audience.
Well, it has been such a pleasure and a privilege to come to Iran and to see the reality of people here. And I just hope that you understand that our government in the United States is not the same as the people. The people absolutely want peace. I think even now, many in our government want peace. And so that is what the message that I will take back to the United States from here is, that there is no enemy in Iran. And we could actually be friends and live in a totally functional, happy world where everybody's having mutually beneficial arrangements and agreements. And the greatest obstacle to that is, unfortunately, my country and some foreign influence in my country that we are working to reveal. But I think that the inevitable human nature is that we're all going to find ourselves in a more sovereign, more politically independent, and happy world, because at the end of the day, I think we all want the same thing, which is a better life for our children. And so we're going to work to strive to make that happen in the United States, and I know that the brave Iranian people will do the same.
Thank you, Ania. It was a pleasure to talk to you here at SORP. I really wanted this conversation to go on, but we are at the end of the program. And thank you so much. This is the end of another SORP. But remember, SORP means only the beginning of the day. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Urayi.
Wishes to see you one day, 'cause I'm in need. Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, "Allah is beautiful and loves beauty." Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. And the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Black and White. The program covers the latest developments in Latin America and tells you what is happening in this strategically important region. Spring of Truth will follow next. This program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. And we finish off this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Black and White.
The desire for independence and sovereignty, along with the struggle against hegemonism and interference, fundamentally against imperialism, represents a contradiction that permeates our entire era and will likely continue to do so until it's resolved in favor of the peoples. In other words, as long as imperialism exists, the peoples and nations, each with their unique perspectives, respond to this reality in various ways, depending on the nature of their governments and systems. How do you confront imperialism? How do you tackle foreign interference?
A la injerencia extranjera.
One of the strategies is to find ways to develop multilateral entities, which brings us to the concept of unilateralism. Various organizations are established, which, by the way, are not uniform. They contain contradictions because their members hold different positions. And then we see the interveners, the imperialists, and the reactionaries get to work to stop them on more than one occasion. This even happens in one of the most prestigious organizations today, which is making significant progress, like the BRICS. There are even clashes within it. What occurred during the conflict, the armed skirmishes between India and Pakistan, speaks for itself.
Allí, parte de los integrantes.
Well, we all know that India is already a BRICS member, a very important one. But then we have Pakistan, a country which is very close to joining this organization. In addition, there's also the People's Republic of China, which has very good ties with Pakistan. The United States is behind India, and this shows there are numerous inflationary matters there. Therefore, multilateral organizations are not uniform. However, it's a space where dialogue and unity are sought to confront aggression and hegemony. This hegemony is currently manifesting itself in a brutal manner, as seen in the aggression of NATO and the United States against the Russian Federation, using Ukraine as a pawn.
Y en forma brutal, pero realmente criminal, a la entidad sionista.
Additionally, this is brutally and criminally targeting the inflationary tactics to erase or attempt to erase the Palestinian nation.
Y para agredir en forma cobarde.
In addition, in a cowardly and criminal manner, they aim to attack their main enemy in the region, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
La República Islámica de Irán.
The Islamic Republic of Iran, like others in a similar situation, looks to its neighbors and friendly nations for opportunities to engage in multilateral efforts. They seek ways to form alliances, even if they are temporary and specific, to confront this aggression. Because aggressions should be met with weapons and with diplomacy together. This is why multilateral organizations are always good, despite their deficiencies. Because what more deficiencies can a multilateral organization like the UN have, which is unable to resolve or act in these wars? The United Nations was established to prevent war, yet it has failed to stop any. It's completely out of the picture. It lacks the capacity. Nevertheless, multilateralism remains a tool for the world nations and a space to pursue peace, ultimately aiming to twist the arm of the imperialist powers. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Multilateralismo. ¿Qué es?
What is multilateralism? What phenomena does it respond to? Why does it occur? Is it the solution to social and political issues? And can it be supported by any social system? Is it a phenomenon of our times, or does it have roots in the past, fundamentally speaking? To explore this issue in depth, we have a special guest joining us from Mexico. Nayar López Castellanos is an academic and researcher at the Faculty of Political and Social Sciences at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Welcome, Nayar, to Black and White.
Bienvenido, Nayar, a nuestro programa Negro y Blanco.
¿Qué tal, Eduardo?
How are you, Eduardo? Nice to meet you. Thank you.
En la introducción decíamos...
In the introduction, we mentioned that we need to understand what multilateralism is and whether it's a phenomenon of our times or if it has historical precedents in the past, in other movements with different names, such as the Non-Aligned Movement or the Politics of the Third World, which was proposed by the People's Republic of China at that time. So where does it have some of its roots?
Bueno, sobre todo podríamos ubicarlo...
Well, we could primarily place it around the mid-20th century, at the time when World War II came to an end and a series of spaces and mechanisms began to emerge within a nation's or UN being the main reference point. This even had its counterpart in our Latin American and Caribbean region. For instance, the first space or sub-region that has started to take shape in this dynamic is Central America, with the organization of Central American states known as ODECA and even the establishment of the Central American Common Market around 1954. Other mechanisms also began to arise in various areas of the region, contributing to what is referred to as multilateralism. This obviously has roots in the dynamics of U.S. interventionism, such as the Pan-American vision they have always sought to impose on our continent. Since the late 19th century, they aimed to create a sort of Pan-American Union, which was more about formalizing their Monroe Doctrine logic and hegemony over our countries. But it never really materialized into a specific space. Well, after that, we move into the realm of Latin American and Caribbean affairs, and even at the continental level, we encounter what we know as the OAS, the Organization of American States, which fundamentally serves the interests of the United States. Additionally, as we approach the end of the century, we see the emergence of various other organizations, particularly in Latin America and the Caribbean. This trend of multilateralism is solidifying in this century with significant mechanisms such as UNASUR, ALBA, MERCOSUR, PetroCARIB, the Caribbean Community, the AEC, and a collection of over 15 different types of spaces, culminating in the recent establishment of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Thus, we have a scenario where multiple mechanisms of various kinds exist, some with economic or merely commercial characteristics, within the framework of neoliberalism, including free trade agreements, which also serve as forms of multilateral mechanisms, among others.
Well, there is a clear distinction between the interventionist policy of the United States and its dominance, and it must be stated as such, even if it's cloaked in a guide multilateralism, support and cooperation across all areas, which is quite different from true multilateralism. This concept fundamentally arises in countries that possess a social system aiming for sovereignty and independence, striving for their own development and self-sustainability from a governance perspective, right? How is this contradiction evident today, for instance, with the organizations we have?
Well, of course, undoubtedly, the older mechanisms, like the UN, for instance, which has been going through a crisis for several years now, reflect that any mechanism that can be controlled or manipulated, or even unknown, meaning to surpass it through actions, ultimately becomes a space for U.S. intervention. If we consider the case of the UN, how many times have different decisions been made from there, such as the one that condemned the United States to pay $16 billion to Sandinista Nicaragua when a complaint was filed in The Hague? Remember when that happened? And on the other hand, as you rightly point out, there are mechanisms that have aimed to consolidate, let's say, or move towards true sovereignty and independence against these powers, which in the most particular case of our region is the United States, but also includes the influence of Europe and those who have experienced various forms of attacks from this imperial logic that the United States embodies. A concrete example is UNASUR. UNASUR, which at one point managed to function as a genuine multilateral mechanism that contributed to regional political coexistence with governments of differing ideologies, played a crucial role in resolving various types of conflicts, didn't it? However, the United States, through its actions, even with supportive leaders like Mauricio Macri in Argentina or Bolsonaro at one point, effectively led to the extinction of UNASUR, which has nearly vanished. In fact, in the case of Ecuador, the headquarters was removed, and so on. Therefore, there exists a dispute between two views of multilateralism that are undoubtedly very prominent in the current landscape of our complex and troubled planet, where the weight of U.S. interests often shapes international dynamics. In the meantime, the logic of multilateralism has been strengthening. Let's remember what Hugo Chavez emphasized in his time. Multipolarity, right? This means the ability to create various types of space globally, where international relations are not dictated by who has the most powerful military or the strongest investment, but rather by the needs for healthy coexistence, we would say in the best sense, among countries facing similar challenges and above all, seeking to break free from the heavy chains of hegemony, primarily that of the United States.
Indeed, it's the hegemony of the United States. We'll take a break now, Nayar, and we'll be right back.
Estamos de vuelta acá en Negro y Blanco con Nayar López desde México.
We're back here on Black and White with Nayar López from Mexico. Well, Nayar, we're observing the interference from the United States, but also the ongoing crisis within the multilateral movements and organizations. This constant crisis, along with many others, often arises from shifts in social systems or changes in government direction. Although there are sometimes disagreements within multilateral movements, for example, the BRICS, which we can categorize as part of the multilateralism movement, but anyway, they are seen as a solution, aside from the disagreements within. Recently, there was almost a war between India and Pakistan, with China backing Pakistan, and India is also part of the BRICS, as is China, which is significant. What I mean to convey is that multilateralism is the solution to the issues faced by nations striving for sovereignty, independence, self-determination, and ultimately confronting imperialism, breaking free from the clutches of imperialism. What do you think?
Salir de las garras del imperialismo o una parte de aquello?
Yo pensaría que es una parte de aquello en la medida en que finalmente los mecanismos multilaterales que hemos conocido.
I think, unlike other versions of it, that is the European Union, the multilateral mechanisms that we have known have not yet reached an integration that, while respecting national sovereignties, play roles in a much higher tier than the multilateral mechanisms. I mean, they have numerous untapped potentials. In other words, scenarios like CELAC, BRICS, UNASUR, and ALBA have limitations in that they don't propose a restructuring of the international economic order, nor do they necessarily aim to overcome the capitalist system that is leading humanity to disaster. Instead, they have established different areas of collaboration, cooperation, exchange, and trade, even so advanced that we could say they are considering a currency alternative to the hegemonic dollar, as seen in the case of BRICS, or particularly Russia and Iran have common currency for all types of trade. So I believe this is part of the political processes within countries that accompany this new way of understanding international relations, particularly multilateralism, towards mechanisms that ensure strong structures against what the American empire represents. I think they go hand in hand, but the extent or the main objective will determine the outcome. As you rightly pointed out, a center government, a leftist one or a right-wing one, can significantly influence how much a country participates in that multilateral scenario, or how much it even withdraws, like the despicable Bolsonaro did when he suspended Brazil from CELAC at the time, or when they created that blatantly unconditional experiment of the United States called PROSUR, which supposedly aimed to find alternatives for their countries, but in reality, it was about sabotage, and they ultimately succeeded in that regard.
That's right. Nayar, let me give you the following example. In Chile, there is some debate about whether or not to join the BRICS. And it's interesting to see that there are sectors of the upper bourgeoisie that even view joining the BRICS positively. The question is, who benefits from fairer trade and more reciprocal relationships rather than subjugation? How does that translate to the people, to the sectors that are currently marginalized, or continue to earn the same as always, as long as there is no change in social organization or a different political direction in the country? So yes, these organizations are good, but it depends on who is in government, don't you think?
¿Cuál es la
Por supuesto. Sí, no, totalmente de acuerdo con tu planteamiento porque...
I completely agree with your perspective as it mirrors the situation in Mexico. In other words, we have a government that has been promoting some very significant initiatives, such as the recent election of the judiciary, which is a landmark event in the region, alongside Bolivia, which has been doing this for some time. However, the internal economic order remains just as it was during the neoliberal era. To put it differently, macroeconomics is the crucial element that needs attention. While there is social redistribution through various programs, the capitalist system persists unchanged, and we still have a small portion of the society earning $1 million every hour, contrasted with 50 million people living in poverty and facing inequality, as well as the violence we are experiencing in our country, for instance. Indeed, the scenario you present is the same. Being part of the BRICS does contribute to reorganization, so to speak, of international economic relations, reducing the influence and significance of the United States in these relationships. However, if the international economic order itself is not altered, if the capitalist system is not changed at both the national and global levels, then the social conditions in our nations will not fundamentally improve. There may be social programs, scholarships, and various initiatives that can serve as temporary relief or be seen as redistribution, but ultimately, the root causes of inequality and marginalization inherent in capitalism in countries like ours remain unaddressed. In this regard, I believe that while all these mechanisms are indeed beneficial and important, they must also reflect a deeper internal change in our countries through structural reforms, rather than relying solely on good social policies, which could easily be dismantled by a right-wing government, leaving everything unchanged.
Puede venir un gobierno de derecha a desmontar toda esa estructura y no pasó nada, ¿no?
Así es. Ahora,
that's right. Now, is there a reference point, for instance, with the experience of the non-aligned countries at that time, that movement? Can we discuss multilateralism during that period?
Sí, por supuesto. Yo creo que fue una experiencia muy importante que reflejó.
Yes, of course. I believe it was a very significant experience that reflected how a strong alliance was empowered, let's say, among countries that shared similar political, economic, and social realities. And additionally, it occurred during a time when this intense phase of colonialism was also coming to an end, although it hasn't completely finished, as there are still 20 territories in the Caribbean under neocolonial conditions. However, at that time, the non-aligned movement represented the possibility of coexistence among nations without the dominance of the two power poles that existed back then, one of which is now clearly identified as the United States. This bears some resemblance, for instance, to BRICS, but I think the current mechanism that best embodies the spirit of the non-aligned movement, even reflecting what the Mutual Economic Assistance Agreement represented in the socialist bloc, is ALBA. To me, ALBA represents the Bolivarian alternative for the peoples of our America, fully known as the Treaty of Commerce of the Peoples. It seems to me to be the most advanced multilateral mechanism and is for integration in the world, to the extent that it is not a mechanism that serves the economic interests of imperialism, but rather the social development of peoples and the reduction of asymmetries between countries.
Y para la disminución de las asimetrías entre países, ¿no?
Así es. Nayar, en una palabra para terminar.
That's right, Nayar. To sum it up, in one word, what does the future hold for the multilateralism movement?
Multilateralismo.
Pues creo que es bastante.
I believe it holds great promise. There are numerous opportunities to reshape power structures globally within a context of reciprocity, cooperation, solidarity, and respect. It's not about a relationship where military bases are used to coerce acceptance of a trade agreement, but rather about relationships where countries can engage in exchange and, most importantly, adopt a social perspective. That's how I see it.
Well, Nayar Lopez, a big hug to you. Thank you so much for being with us here on Black and White.
Likewise, Eduardo, it's my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, Allah. انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from iRibe English Radio This is Zainab Mousavi and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and then try to shed light and talk about some of these beautiful viewpoints Well, about the conspiracy of America and Israel, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, the Zionist regime of Israel is a usurper and oppressor, and its existence is a continuous crime against the Palestinian people. You see, this quotation from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh reflects a critical perspective that is rooted in the ideological and theological framework of Islam regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You know, from a Muslim perspective, especially that of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, the land of Palestine holds profound spiritual and historical significance as a part of a broader Muslim ummah. You know, the assertion that Israel is a usurper and oppressor aligns with the view that the establishment of the Zionist entity involved the unjust expropriation of Palestinian lands and the displacement of its people. It is considered as a great injustice. Muslim theology emphasizes justice, or what we call as adl, as a divine attribute and opposition to tyranny and oppression is central to its moral stance. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, like many Islamic scholars, considers the occupation of Palestine a form of tyranny that contravenes divine justice.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala.
And the Holy Book of Quran condemns injustice and usurpation, for example, in Surah Al-Anfal, verse number 50. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. And if you could see when the angels take the souls of those who disbelieved, they are striking their faces and their backs. You see, this verse underscores the divine justice against the oppressors. And furthermore, in the hadith and narrations from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam, they all emphasize resistance against tyranny. For example, a famous narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam advocates fighting against oppression and standing for justice. And in summary, the quotation condemns the Israeli regime based on divine justice. And based on historical injustice and based on the moral imperative to oppose the oppressors, as it is supported by the Holy Book of Quran and the teachings of the prophets and imams, and we should take care of that point very well.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night.
was Spring of Truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Don't you worry, follow the sign, leave the story to the divine. Free yourself and say what's true. Be yourself, though you may be few.
Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram.
You can see straight into my soul. You know in hardship I changed my goals. Now I realize I was so unwise. Abandoned your advice,
faced with your pride.
Help was always near if we persevered,
if we held up
just for a while.
Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa.
Without you, nothing I've gained is without you. If you are pleased, my soul can breathe. Where would I be without you? My heart now flees these worldly dreams, yearning for mercy from you. Now I realize I was so unwise. Abandoned your advice,
faced with your pride.
Help was always near if we persevered,
if we held up
just for a while.
Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, 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 ya Allah, salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Al-Hadi al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram.
It was an aggression that broke international norms and laws. But when it comes to the Israeli regime, there is no law. There are no international norms. Targeted assassinations in an effort to impact Iran's military and nuclear apparatus failed. And this came at a cost for Israel, not only an economic one, but one that could have wiped it out were it not for the U.S. intervention. Israel's 12-day aggression, a 12-day war of aggression, parts of occupied Palestine completely destroyed from military bases to research centers. economic costs is still being assessed. Israel's GDP shattered. Israel's economy contracts again, mounting war expenses topping $12 billion and looming public financial challenges. The Israeli economy is paying the price of the 12-day aggression. Economic crisis deepens. Meanwhile, the economic crisis deepens, capital flight and brain drain, with industries losing hope of recuperating their losses. It's now a fight for their survival. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Dr. Issa Bloomi, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University, and Diane Serre, political analyst and independent candidate for U.S. Senate from New York State.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and inshallah there will be peace for Iran and the larger region. Much of the economic model for the colonial state is one of subsidy. It draws enormous rent from the occupied territories, from stolen natural resources, but also huge amounts of support from Europe primarily, and especially the United States. The destruction of infrastructure and some of the older neighborhoods in cities like Tel Aviv and other towns, those will be targeted for rebuilding, reconstruction, with considerable economic benefits for those who are able to secure the contracts, the financing, and ultimately the new valuation of these properties. It's interesting to note that a lot of the people whose homes or businesses have been damaged or destroyed by this last small war will not get their properties back. This is kind of the quintessential disaster capitalism that will now kick in, and much of the older infrastructure is going to be rebuilt in a new way. And again, subsidized by outside investors.
This is a map of where the Israeli aggression targeted in the Islamic Republic, and one showing what areas Iran targeted and hit in the occupied Palestine. From a visual perspective, this is very effective, since it debunks any non-believers out there who think that Israel overwhelmed Iran. Plus, it shows how Iran shattered Israel's invincibility. Going into the Israeli aggression, Israel was suffering in different industries. As shown here, we picked three for you: tourism, construction, and agriculture. It is pretty obvious that tourism has suffered the most and continues to bleed since Israel's aggression and war seems to have no end.
There's going to be considerable amount of assistance coming from, in the shape or form of basically interest-free loans, which has always been the case for the Israeli economy, again, largely subsidized by the outside world. But because of the nature of the war itself and some of the infrastructure that was outdated and needed to be rebuilt anyways, I'm being very cynical about this, but also I see this as moving forward. There's going to be an opportunity to actually enter in and restructure the some of these, especially service economies. There are probably going to be a push towards less labor-intensive service economies. One of the big issues that the Israeli economy will have moving forward is actually attracting labor, since the colonists themselves are not the most useful laborers in terms of construction, of agriculture, of tourism services. There will be a restructuring of especially tourism. There's going to be now, with the newly acquired Golan Heights, with the destruction and elimination of Gaza, there's going to be a period of heavy investment in construction and rebuilding, with a new kind of tourism awaiting in the after all this rebuilding takes place. That's if, of course, there's a stability moving forward. But I see this is just as a transitional phase, unfortunately, which, with the exception of a few small players, there's going to be a hell of a lot of money made on the back of suffering in the larger region, and it's going to be the usual suspects who are profiting from rebuilding a new kind of colonialist economy moving forward.
This is the social section of the program. Israel's economy is in shambles. They are in massive debt. Tourism is completely dead. The Houthis are damaging their economy. Massive boycotts globally are damaging their economy. And Israeli settlers are fleeing. The Zionist regime is crumbling. Israel went into a tailspin as the 12-day conflict with Iran has squeezed its economy dry, and experts say that it escaped an economic meltdown only because of the U.S. brokered the ceasefire. The real reason Trump and Netanyahu ended the war with Iran and are looking to end the genocide in Gaza are Israel's economy is hemorrhaging. The Iran 12-day way is estimated to have cost Israel's $4 billion on a conservative basis, a costly transformation of Israel's economic future is being driven by the war. This infographic visually unpacks the immense financial burden using key economic indicators to expose the true depth of the drain and the long-term price of the conflict.
I think Israel cannot afford it. I read recently that already in Israel, 20% of the population is below the poverty line. So this clearly is not affordable unless they are getting massive outside support. And even so, I don't know many people who wish to live in a war zone, and Israel. The point of Israel is that it's supposed to be a safe country. So I think this puts them in a very difficult situation.
The economic impact of the Israeli aggression on Iran left Israel facing billions of dollars in direct military expenses, economic losses, and a looming budget deficit, like spending $5 billion in the first week alone, $725 million per day in total war expenses. The total estimated impact is set to be $20 billion, a figure that is a guesstimate since the investigations are ongoing on the extent of the damage.
I think ultimately the